For those that don't know me, I'm John Davey from South Australia. I go to the South Adelaide meeting over there. I've had absolutely nothing at all to do with CareLinks up to now. I met Duncan for the first time yesterday. And he invited me to come and speak at the conference here because of some of the contributions I'd made to some forums. So I sort of ask myself regularly who am I and what am I doing here, but I really am very thankful to Duncan and to Cindy for the work that they've done and for inviting me here, and to Steve and Robin for putting me up. It's been such a gracious experience on my part to receive such kindness. We all belong to a community that loves God. We all live in the love of God, and we seek to promote that love. And it's probably a little strange, I suppose, that I should be talking about seeking the face of God, when in fact the conference here is really about an outreach. It's about us reaching out and shining our lights. But the way that we think about the love of God is so often with respect to God's love toward us. And I think we don't talk often enough about our love towards God. And I'm sure we all love God. Everyone here would say that they loved God. But what is the foundations of that love? Does that love have secure foundations? For what reason do we really love God? When you go back, right back to the basics, of course, we have right back when Moses came down from the mountain with the tablets, that first command was to love God. And Jesus reiterated that in Matthew 22, where he says, Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and your neighbour as yourself." So is it that simple? Is that it? It's the law. We have to love God. That's the foundation. Is that the foundation? I think when Moses came down the mountain with those two stone tablets and the people read the first commandment, they would have gone, "What? You can't legislate love." And it's something that was probably put there to make them wake up to that fact, to make them look beyond what was written as a law, that they should actually look at the law and understand that within that law was an invitation to do something far more, something far greater. They were asked to love God with every fibre of their being. Not just a casual love, not just an offside love, but with every fibre of their being. And clearly that's not something that can be legislated. So it can't be just the law. So if we're trying to keep the law, well, heck, what if I don't have the feelings? What if I don't have the emotional relationship with God that lets me love him? What if I'm devoid of that? What if I don't relate somehow? Well, I think John helps us a little bit when he says in 1 John 4, verse 10, he says, "This is love, not that we loved God, but that he first loved us and sent his son to be an atoning sacrifice," or a meeting place, a mercy seat for us, so that we are able to meet with him at that place. This is God reaching out his arm to us, saying, "Here, meet with me." And he gave his son for that purpose. So we respond naturally to the love of God. We always respond to love. If someone loves us, we respond with love. That's only natural. But is that enough? Is it enough just to respond love for love? What if God was a wicked God? Like the pagans had, or the Greeks, or the Romans, they all had their wicked gods. What would a wicked God really look like? A wicked God would probably reward the abusers. He'd probably reward those that were the strongest, the most intelligent, the most cunning, the most able, the most sporting, the one with all the physical attributes. He'd reward those because they deserved it, because they had those rewards, those attributes. And those that were sick and lame and poor, well, he'd ignore those altogether. He'd arrange for them to be persecuted. Interesting, isn't it, that that is exactly how we understand the Darwinist doctrine of survival of the fittest. The Darwin, in effect, promoted a God who was the absolute antithesis of our God. So we love God not just because he loves us, but we love God because he is righteous. And those two twin characteristics of God, I imagine them like two pillars, the two great pillars of the character of God. We have his love and we have his righteousness. And to Israel, when they perceived those two characteristics, in fact, when Moses came down from the mount, when Moses was still in the mount and the Lord came down to him and Moses wanted to see the glory of God, the Lord passed by him and he proclaimed, the Lord compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love for thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion and sin, yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. So God had revealed himself. He had revealed this character to Moses. Moses asked, I want to see your glory. God showed him his glory. Because God doesn't glory in his power. He doesn't glory in his wisdom and his knowledge. He glories in his righteousness and his compassion. Because this is the character of God. This is God. He glories in his righteousness and his compassion. So when Moses came down from the ark and God had revealed his glory to Moses, Moses' face shone because he had seen the glory of God. It's a bit of a paradox, actually, when we stop and think about these two twin characteristics, the righteousness and the love of God. And I think Israel saw the problem that, in fact, is it Habakkuk says, chapter 1, verse 13, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? See, the problem is that if God is perfectly righteous and he is also perfectly loving and he loves us who are sinners, those two characteristics sort of sit awkwardly with each other. They don't sit easily side by side. They are divergent ideas. Well, so it appears. In fact, when you think about it a little bit more, we discover that it's far from that. If we just look at Isaiah 30, verse 18. Isaiah writes, Yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. He rises to show you compassion. Why? Because the Lord is a God of justice. So the fact that God is a God of justice is his reason for showing us compassion. Someone wise once said, without love there's no justice. And I think you can say conversely, there's no justice without love. The two concepts actually aren't divergent, they're convergent. They lean upon each other. We couldn't trust the love of God if he wasn't righteous. And God's righteousness would not exist if he was not loving. So these two ideas, these two concepts, which form the character of God, are in effect one and the same. God's righteousness is a compassionate righteousness. It's not a legal righteousness. And that's something that's tripped up, I believe, a number of people in our community for years, because they have seen God's righteousness as a legal righteousness, that God is somehow bound by law, by his own righteousness, not to forgive unless certain conditions are met. But that's not the case. God's righteousness is nothing to do with these constraints, these legal constraints. God's righteousness is to do with his love. When you stop and have a look at all of the laws of Moses, they're all about loving your neighbour, being respectful to them, respecting their property rights, being faithful to your wife, not lying, not cheating, not abusing. They're all about the way we live. They're about living decent lives. So all of these righteous aspects of the law are underpinned by an empathy for the other person. Empathy for the other person underpins all righteousness. So when Moses came down from the mount, his face shone. This is a marvellous picture, isn't it? And I imagine that it would have been quite astounding to the Israelites at the time to see this man with his face shining. It would have been so different. We're very visual creatures, aren't we? I think all of our environment, all of our understanding of our environment is mostly understood through what we see. We understand height and depth and width and breadth and colour and shade and all the rest of it through sight. We're very sight-focused creatures. The whole world we understand through the image that we construct in our mind of the things, the light coming in through our eyes makes these images on the back of our eyes, and our brain takes those images and it constructs the universe inside our mind, so that we understand the universe through the things that we see. When a child is first born, and I became a grandfather about 4 or 5 months ago, and I've seen this in my own grandchild and my daughter. When an infant first starts to see, when they first lock eyes with their parent, it's a magic moment. And there in the silence, with no communication other than their locked eyes, there is in fact two-way communication. In a way, the child says, I know you're there. And I know that you know I'm here. It is the very foundation of the relationship between a child and their parent. So it's with our face, with our eyes, that we declare what's inside of us. We declare our moods, our character, the way we think, the way we interact with others. It's all done through our face, through our facial expressions, through our eyes. And looking with your eyes, you can be welcoming, you can be abusive, and you can be a little threatening, you might be a little quizzical. And I'm thinking of some of the slides that Belinda had up there before of some of these people in Romania. The poor old fellow certainly had a quizzitive look on his face, didn't he? And he was communicating that quite effectively by the look that he gave. So with our eyes, with our faces, we communicate. And we communicate very effectively unless we choose to mask our feelings. And we can mask our feelings. We can put on a deadpan face. Or we can show a happy face when we're crying. So we can mask our feelings. But if our feelings are true to the way we are inside, then we communicate that very effectively to the people that we share glances with. So it's no surprise then that we're asked to seek God, to seek his face. There's a lovely passage, I think, in 2 Chronicles 7, reading from verse 11 to 16. When Solomon had finished building the temple, he'd finished dedicating the temple. And it says, verse 12, the Lord appeared to him at night and said, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a temple for sacrifices. When I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or commands locusts to devour the land and send a plague among my people, if my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and will heal their land. Now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayers offered in this place. I have chosen and consecrated this temple so that my name may be there forever. My eyes and my heart will always be there. It's a bit of a daunting thought, actually, to look into the eyes of God. If we feel guilty. Which is why Adam, I guess, hid himself from God. To seek the face of God means that, in effect, you are asking for God's approval. You're asking for his acceptance. You are declaring to God that you are living a life that is fit to be the life led by one of his children. You're approaching him as a father. You know, it's way too easy for us to also mask the face of God from us. And there's a lot of ways that we can do that. We can hide from God by not praying. We can hide from God by actually having very stilted services. If you've got a service that follows the same old rituals, the same old thing each week, people come along, do the same things, all stand up, sing the same prayers, sit down, listen to the talk, go home. It's masking the face of God. There's no vibrancy in that at all. There's no love, there's no passion, there's no uniqueness about each occasion. Very easy to mask the face of God. And we will do that if we feel uncomfortable looking into his face. You know, if my children came to me and their faces were always downcast, looking at their feet, and they mumbled something about, oh, gee, I've done all this stuff wrong today, Dad, I'm really sorry. If they always approached me that way, I would be asking myself, who do my children think that I am? They think I'm some sort of ogre. I'd expect my children to come and look me in the face. It would be something that I would desire. It's not something that I would be offended by. I wouldn't consider them presumptuous if they looked me in the face. I would be delighted. And if they looked me in the face and said, hey, Dad, I screwed up today. Can you come and help me fix it? I'd be delighted. Something that I've adopted in recent years that I suppose came to me a little slowly is when I pray, I now try to pray not with my head bowed. I try to pray with my face lifted. I try to imagine the eyes of God. And that makes the prayer much more personal. You know, if you pray with your head down and God's just sort of out there somewhere and you're saying all these things, you think, oh, hoping he's hearing it up there somewhere. But if you imagine looking into the eyes of God while you're praying, then through that encounter, through that sight, through that vision, you also communicate a faith and a trust and a depth of relationship. And I challenge you all to try it. It's a hard habit to break, actually, bowing your heads in prayer, because we've all been doing it for years. But it's something that, and it's not insolence. God knows your heart. And if you are able to do this with a clear heart, with a clear conscience, to look into the eyes of God as you're praying, you find that it will make your prayers much more real. They'll be much deeper. Paul writes to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians, he says, we are not like Moses, who put a veil over his face to keep the Israelites from gazing at it while the radiance was fading away. But their minds were made dull even unto this day. The same veil remains when the Old Testament is read. It has not been removed because only in Christ is it taken away. Even to this day, when Moses is read, a veil covers their hearts. But whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. There is a confidence, isn't there? And we, who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. So if we're going to let our light shine, yeah, that's the theme of the conference, isn't it? If we're going to let our light shine, then we need that encounter. We need that encounter with the righteousness of God, and with his love and his compassion. We need to see his glory for what it is. We need to understand that it is his glory to shed his love and his spirit into our hearts and our lives. And it is only when we have that glory residing in our hearts, it's only when his spirit is in our hearts, that we are able to show forth his glory. Now, it's really quite easy for us to fake it. You know, we can go out and say we're shining the glory of God because We know all these intellectual things. Okay? And so I can be quite dazzling with a bit of intellect. Well, I think I can. Or with a bit of knowledge. And some people might be quite dazzling with their accounts of their efforts in his service. And they can shine a glory. They can be quite brilliant. They can be quite dazzling. But it's not God's glory. The glory of God comes from God dwelling in us. It is a fire that has to be real. Not like the fire of Nadab and Abihu. It has to be a real fire. It has to be a God-lit fire. The fire has to come from God. It has to be a passion for God and for all that his glory represents. Failure to do that will be failure to show forth his glory. We won't be able to shine his light because his light will not be in us. Jesus says in Luke, "See to it then." This is Luke chapter 11, verse 35. "See to it then," he says, "that the light within you is not darkness." How can a light be darkness? Light can't be darkness, surely. Well, it can, if it's not God's light. And if the light that is within us, the light that we are displaying to other people, is a whole bunch of facts, a whole bunch of knowledge, a whole bunch of ability to string together logical arguments, if it's a whole bunch of revelations about all of the hard works that we've done, it's nothing to do with the light of God. It's darkness. So my prayer for you all today comes from Numbers chapter 6. And you all know it by heart. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace.